ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We're in the mountains in Europe, where there are forests and meadows, and a 27-kilometre tunnel that scientists shoot lasers in. It's CERN, and it costs billions to build, and it's just about to be brought to a halt by a bird with a baguette. I'm Dr. Anne Jones, and in my new series for What the Duck, I'm taking on nature's most wanted, the animals that end up on the wrong side of the law. Find What the Duck on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Meredith Lake. Great to have your company for Soul Search and for some honest conversations today about death and dying. How is death changing in contemporary Australia? And given our mortal condition, are there ways we can tend each other better?
We live currently in Australia in what is quite a death-averse society, right? Death is taboo and death is often sequestered away from the world of the living. And that's really unfortunate. Talking about death will help you make your end of life and dying better, not just for yourself, but also for your loved ones, for everyone's around you. So there's a kind of practical preparatory element, but then there's also this element that it actually might also help you live better, not just die better.
The value of death are these networks of care. That's what it is. You know, these ecologies of care that can start to form around dying and death care and grieving. And that's ultimately what we people are hungry, we're famished for. You know, these opportunities really bring us back to being present.
It's really personal, death. And at the same time, it's something shared. And you're going to hear more about what that means for the possibilities of care. But right now, meet Hannah Gould. She's a cultural anthropologist, and she describes herself as an amateur mortal and a professional death scholar. Her new book is How to Die in the 21st Century. Hello, Hannah.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So when in your life did you become so interested in death?
Well, it's kind of funny writing this book that I've had the opportunity now to look back on my life and realize that actually, you know, a lot of my early childhood and even high school, I had quite a number of people around me die. But I always thought that was kind of, you know, normal, a part of, you know, grandparents die and pets die and you cope with it. But it probably wasn't really until my undergraduate years at the University of Melbourne, and I was going through my honours in anthropology, and within the course of a year, my dad got very, very ill and died. And all of a sudden, this thing which was kind of intellectually, professionally interesting became quite personally interesting and important to me. Looking back in retrospect, it's been 12 years now almost to the day, and, you know, it is incredibly young. And I'm very privileged to be able to say that. You know, I know a lot of people have bereavements much earlier in their life. But it did kind of force me, I suppose, to confront a lot of things that people, you know, usually confront in their 40s or 50s when they're caring for aging parents.
I was in my mid-20s, actually, when I was first bereaved of a parent, Hannah. Oh, and I think that...
You're a member of the Dead Dad Club.
As you were.
Yeah.
I think that has made a difference.
Yeah. I think there's something quite significant about facing death when you yourself are in this period of your 20s when you're trying to work out who you want to be. I'm currently teaching a big subject called death at the University of Melbourne, and we have over 200 students in it studying death and dying. And, you know, all of these students in their 20s are having this journey of like thinking about who they are and what they want to do with their lives, but in relationship, knowing, having this knowledge of mortality. And it's really quite powerful, actually. As much as, you know, I never want to say that losing my dad so early was beneficial or a good thing, I do think in very many ways it was such an important lesson in me figuring out who I am, because I kind of, the stakes were raised for me quite early in my life, I suppose, in some ways.
Yeah, and you have pursued those questions in a scholarly way. I mean, why? I mean, it's one thing to ask them of yourself, but why do you think it's important that we not only talk about death, but even study it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, in some ways, you know, people ask me why I study death. It's like, well, what other question is worth asking? I mean,
it's a big one, sure.
It's a big one. I'm never going to fix it. I'm never going to finish it. You know, death studies hasn't solved death, unfortunately, and I'm not actually sure that death is one of those things that we can solve or we should try and solve. But it just touches every aspect of our life and experience. Like, you know, I can connect gender inequality to death. I can connect the contemporary housing crisis to death.
Hey, hang on. You're going to have to explain that one and join those dots for me, Hannah. Yeah. Okay,
yeah. Well, the housing crisis, more and more people don't own their own home, so they're renting. And so people are now not burying their pets in the backyard. They are, in fact, cremating their pets or bringing them with them. And so pet cremation has become a massive sector within contemporary Australian death and dying directly because of the rental slash housing crisis.
I'd love to talk to you about some of the ways that death and dying has changed and perhaps could change in the 21st century. One of the things that I learned from your book, though, Hannah, is that there's kind of a social or collective urgency perhaps to this, in that you talk about how as a society we're approaching peak death. What does that mean?
Yes, peak death is a term that we use to refer to the projected rise in overall mortality in our society. So put simply, in Australia, but in many places around the world, we live in aging societies. So what's likely to happen by about 2040 is that our death rate will double. And so we'll have more people dying than ever before. And that has a lot of effects for the society. It has impacts with regards to how much burial space we have, how many cemeteries, how many crematorium we have. It has impacts for things regarding end-of-life care, concerns about informal labour. Often it's women who are performing this informal labour of looking after their ageing and dying parents. Kind of all of this resourcing that we really haven't had to think about up until now because we haven't reached this moment of peak death. So peak death is coming, and I think Australia probably needs to prepare a little better for it.
And that's a collective task. It's a policy challenge in some ways, even an urban planning one, as you've said, Hannah, which is they're not the the vocabularies that we often draw on to discuss death, really.
No, and it's interesting because I think, as I said, everyone thinks that death is unchanging and people tend to think that death is quite personal. But it is a collective, you know, as you said, a policy challenge. It's an urban planning challenge, you know. It's a challenge of employment law. Right? How many days of bereavement leave do we have? What is the economic impact of bereavement? All of these kind of big policy questions that we don't often consider death into, I think because we're kind of afraid of thinking about death and dying to begin with. It's a taboo, scary topic. And unfortunately, what that means is that death is often left out of all of these important policy discussions and legal discussions when it needs to be, you know, front and centre.
One of the steps you've taken, have I got this right? You volunteered for a stint at a crematorium. Tell me what you did and why you did it.
Yeah, so I, in preparation for this book, I did a lot of things. I tried to expose myself as much as possible to the full breadth of our death care system. In the same way we have a multidisciplinary healthcare system, we also have a multidisciplinary death care system. So I worked in a lot of different areas, and one of those was Lilydale Crematorium. Out here in Melbourne. And yeah, I learnt to cremate people. And I worked alongside the team that works there. Shout out to Shane and Rolly and the whole team there. And just to see what it's like to actually have to do that labour, right? What is the physical impact of that labour, which is quite tough, but also the emotional, psychosocial impact of that labour. And trying to understand just how important those workers are, but also, frankly, how poorly they're treated in many ways. I don't think we support our death care workers enough, especially if they're going to be more and more relied upon in this era of peak death.
I think I would find that extremely difficult, Hannah. Did anything surprise you about what it was like to be in that position?
Yeah, existential dread.
Okay.
I really thought that I was kind of numb, or at least like inoculated against the kind of despair that is a result of staring into the abyss of my own mortality and the mortality of everyone I love. But there is something about the mix of everyday workplace banter making a cup of tea, the footy tipping, the weather, what's in the news, with this extraordinarily profound act, which is the final moments of somebody's bodily remains. I just couldn't wrap my mind around. I remember I would drive home and have to kind of just like put on really loud choral orchestral music as I went down the freeway and just trying to piece together what I'd experienced. It is pretty extraordinary, these you know, largely men who work here. I mean, their day-to-day is often, you know, cremating four or five people. It could be somebody in their community that they personally know. A lot of the time it's strangers, but, you know, that includes 90-year-olds and it includes 12-year-olds. It includes infant remains and it includes bad deaths and good deaths. And they see everybody. Everyone in humanity comes through their doors. And they somehow have to piece that together and hold all of that and then go home to their families and go to the footy and, you know, function in society. And I think it's an extraordinarily and really underappreciated work. And increasingly I'm convinced that really what the taboo of death, our discomfort of death creates is this kind of system of silence and oppression for these people where they feel like they can't talk about their work and we don't appreciate the work that they do because we all feel so uncomfortable about it, right? And if we feel uncomfortable talking about it, or if I feel uncomfortable going in there for a couple of days to do work experience, like how uncomfortable must they feel about trying to express their experience day to day to the people around them? You know, there's some kind of solidarity that we have to find with these people that we rely on. Like, you and I don't have to think about death every day because they are doing it, because they're the ones doing the work. And there has to always be somebody doing the work. Mm.
You're listening to Soul Search on Radio National and by podcast with ABC Listen. I'm Meredith Lake, and I'm speaking with Dr. Hannah Gould. She's a cultural anthropologist who researches death and dying, including, as you've just heard, by volunteering at a crematorium. Hannah's new book is How to Die in the 21st Century, and it turns out that death and dying has changed a lot in recent decades.
Yeah, I think there's been extraordinary change. I mean, I think about my grandparents' generation and how they lived and died. Each of my grandparents on my mum's side had 10 siblings, and the vast majority of those siblings didn't make it through to adulthood, right? So child infant mortality rates have incredibly and thankfully decreased as our average age of life and our life expectancy has increased. And so now it's quite a radical shift, actually. Like, today, death is largely a product of old age. And that seems very normal to us, but that's actually quite new for the history of humanity, that we're going to probably die from a chronic condition. So this is something that death studies scholars refer to. It's kind of a bit of a depressing but fun name. This is the kind of period of prolonged dwindling. So how long can you expect to live without significant disability or illness versus how long will you live? And for most people born in Australia today, they can expect to have about a decade or so of some form of illness or disability towards the end of their lives. And what that means is that, you know, we used to die largely from quite sudden or single events. You know, you would have one heart attack, you'd have one diagnosis with cancer. Back in the day, you'd say, you know, one arrow through the heart or falling off a horse or whatever it was. But now it's more likely that we will have a chronic condition, something like Alzheimer's, dementia, that will have multiple different hospital admissions and perhaps an extended period of time which we need care and support from our society in order to function, right? So it's a very different dying trajectory than we previously experienced. So how we die, the kind of rhythm of how we die, has quite radically shifted. And then there are other things that have shifted. So secularization, the types of funerals we have, our choice to bury or cremate, all of these things are really in flux.
I wonder, on that secularization point, if you could just tease out kind of what that's looked like. Again, maybe in our grandparents' generation, it would have been very common to have a funeral and a burial conducted or at least overseen by a religious leader. These days, I suspect that's the minority.
So we're seeing increasingly layperson-led funerals. So funerals that may, you know, include a religious element. You might still have somebody reading the Lord's Prayer, or there might be a poem or a meditation. But they're largely outside of organised religious structures. And that's reflecting, you know, who Australians are and what they believe, right? That is reflected in our wedding ceremonies. So something like 70 to 80% of wedding ceremonies in Australia are now conducted by a civil celebrant. And those civil celebrants are also now conducting many of our funerals. And it's really interesting to look at the contemporary Australian funeral. There's, you know, pop music, popular music. We're not going to religious songs. And there's a slideshow of photos throughout people's lives. And then you go and get a kind of bite to eat. This is the kind of the model that I describe as the pop music, PowerPoint and party pie. The three P's of the Australian contemporary funeral. And that model, though, is actually quite unique around the world.
Historically novel, yeah.
Yeah, it's historically novel. And actually, it's really interesting. It comes from a very particular moment in Australian history. And that is the moment that the then Attorney General, Lionel Murphy, who is the AG under Whitlam, decided to give the power to conduct wedding ceremonies to lay people, to, you know, young women, basically. The first kind of couple of people that he appointed as civil celebrants were in their 20s, right? Young women, Indigenous women. And all of a sudden, the ritual power in our society shifted from largely older men to young women. And there was a movement within civil celebrants emerged to then also take on the funeral service, actually really creating what a secular funeral service might look like.
So you've described this kind of rough template for the contemporary Australian funeral. Talk me through some of the emerging forms of funerals or rituals around that you've come across in, you know, as you've gone looking for ways people die in the 21st century.
Yeah, so probably the most important trend at the moment in funerals that we're seeing is personalization. This kind of idea that the funeral should, at the end of the day, reflect how the dead were when they were living. So their character, their likes, their interests. And this has kind of led to an extraordinary array of different funeral ceremonies that you now no longer have to conduct the funeral at a chapel. You know, you can have the funeral at a park or at the pub. So this is also combined with this rise in cremation. And if people are being cremated before the funeral, which is increasingly the case, then you can have the ashes anywhere. And that's also allowed for like a lot of different rituals. So often it is directly in reflection of what the person loved when they were alive. So there's a great funeral home here in Melbourne, Last Hurrah Funerals. They've done a mosh pit funeral where they had the coffin in the mosh pit at the Tote, a live music venue. They've held a funeral for like a country bloke, young bloke who died, who was really into footy, and they strapped the coffin to the back of the ute. All of his mates rode the ute down to the footy ground, and then they carried his coffin through the goals so that he would kick one final goal. So when you kind of throw out the rule book of what you're supposed to do with funerals, all of a sudden all of these new possibilities emerge. And I think they're very beautiful in many ways because they allow us to focus on a celebration of life and what the person was like and what they loved. And so they kind of, you know, involve the community in keeping that spirit of the dead alive in really stunning ways.
Those are fascinating assumptions or operative assumptions, Hannah, that the funeral expresses the authentic self of the person who's died. That strikes me as quite different to what you might have found in, you know, a religious funeral service where it's perhaps more to do with a meditation on mortality for those who remain alive.
Yeah, and I'm not entirely sure. I mean, you know, I'm a cultural anthropologist. It's not really my place to approve or disapprove of such changes. But I do wonder if there is
something. It's notable, though.
Yeah, it is notable. And I think there perhaps is something lost, you know, in this idea that we're focusing so much on the individual and not on the community, right? And that funerals are now celebrations, but are they also spaces where people can express grief and mourning and contemplate mortality, which, you know, as much as these kind of new funeral ceremonies are interesting and fascinating and kind of quite colourful, you think, wow, you know, a good Christian Catholic mass, a good Latin mass with some incense and some, you know, the smells and bells, that's also very compelling, right, as a ritual to bring the community together to mourn the dead. So there's no real right way or wrong way. I'm just kind of fascinated how people are navigating this balance to create some kind of meaningful ceremony.
These same concerns, I guess, find an expression in relation to how the deceased person is then memorialised or not. And one of the fascinating things you write about in How to Die in the 21st Century is I had no idea about QR codes on headstones, for example.
Yeah, the humble QR code. We've seen this kind of rise again of the QR code on headstones and people now, you know, adding a Spotify playlist to their headstone or, you know, linking it to a YouTube clip or even to a poem or that sort of thing to keep it interactive and to keep people like having a conversation with the dead, even in the cemetery.
So the headstone in a way is a pointer to a digital memorial. Is that kind of how it's working?
Yeah. And I mean, there's been this a lot of energy around digital memorialization. And, you know, that partially is just a result of the fact that people have social media profiles and that when they die, those social media profiles usually persist. And then how do the living interact with those? How does the algorithm serve us up those profiles? And, you know, it's kind of getting, for me at least, increasingly more and more scary with regards to AI and kind of how that personal data is fed into these kind of large language models. But then you also have all of these new ways that people can share memories.
Recipes and family recipes are a really interesting example of this. I had no idea about the TikTok trend of baking the recipe, you know, handed on by the person who's just passed. Tell me more about that. I'm not on TikTok. So this is a brave new world for me,
I teach 20-year-olds. I have to kind of occasionally dip in so I can attempt to be cool. So I think it's actually really fascinating, though, with regards to women's legacy. I think, you know, women's kind of tangible physical memorials have often been sidelined because they are sometimes domestic. So there's all these different projects, one of which is to kind of put your favourite family recipe on your headstone. So, you know, the scone recipe that you're famous for, or the cake recipe or the casserole, to actually have that on your headstone. And then there's this trend of young people kind of finding these headstones, baking the recipes, and then going to the cemetery with those recipes to have a picnic and sharing them, which I think is like, I think it's fabulous. And I love the idea that you're walking through a cemetery and you not only get some nice history, but also a great, you know, recipe for a cheesecake or something, which is kind of lovely.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned AI. Mm. How do you think the rise of this incredible kind of new technology might change the way we're approaching death and dying? Have you speculated much on that yet, or what do you think?
A lot of the time I weep.
True? Why
I mean,
is that?
Well, because I think encountering our mortality is one of those times where we really get to reflect on, like, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to, like, live in the world and think about our finite and shared reality, our lives? And, you know, every so often you hear a story of somebody using AI to write a eulogy. And that makes me so, so sad, because it's like you get the privilege to write a eulogy. It should not be a chore. Like, ChatGPT does not know your friend, you do. And so there's that kind of like casual use of AI that kind of depresses me. But then there's also these kind of emerging uses of AI technology around death and dying that actually give me much more serious concern. So things like your personality and your data being fed into large language models such that these kind of, you know, anyone can then for ask your question, you're kept alive by these AI models, right? And I think we probably actually need to have a right, in the same way we have a right to be forgotten, we need to have a right to remain dead, right? The right to like not be resurrected by AI models. I think even more concerning than that is the use cases of AI at the end of life and this—
In the care stage.
Yeah. So there's a number of these kind of AI models that are digital twins or like patient preference models where, say, you're incapacitated and unable to express your preferences around treatment plans, you know, they might ask a digital twin, or this is the proposed, that they would ask a digital twin and ask an AI that's been fed your personal data about what you would like your care to look like, So wow. as opposed to asking your next of kin.
So as opposed to giving power of attorney to someone that you trust.
Yeah.
And this isn't legal yet, right? This is a proposal or a thought bubble?
No. Well, these are kind of proposed or thought bubbles. And certainly there have been like a lot of cases of them being, you know, started up, and there's a bit of conversation now in bioethics circles about the use of them. Many of them concern me because it reinforces this idea that, like, confronting mortality, that caring for dying people, that caring for our elderly people is a job that we don't want to do, right? This is labour that we can outsource to AI. When I think that's just so incorrect, I think there's so much benefit we can receive in our lives from being with dying and being with dead people. Like, I think the act of care, that labour that you do in caring for a dead person and caring for a dying person, is actually really valuable, not just as a commitment to them of your love and the honour and respect, but in yourself. I think it actually does help you live better to do that work. And so it's, you know, in relying on AI, not only are you robbing the opportunity of somebody to like express their wishes, you're also robbing someone of the opportunity to become a carer and to look after the dying and to go through that journey with them. And I know that's really hard work and we need to support our carers much better, but I actually think it is really valuable human experience that we shouldn't be shying away from.
Hmm. Hannah, of all the concerns I already had about how AI potentially may diminish my humanity, you've just added another really big one that I haven't really thought about. At the same time, I guess on the other end of the spectrum to the technologically saturated dying and death that we've just been talking about is the, you know, the ultimate organic end of life. Talk to me about the rise of what we might call the eco-burial, the natural burial. What do you see happening and what's your read on it, I guess, as we clearly navigate a whole host of very different alternatives around what death care and dying could involve?
Yeah, I mean, green death or eco-death is probably one of the most important trends that we're seeing emerge in death care. And for me, it's very much, you know, linked to a kind of, I suppose, spiritual orientation, right? No longer do we might consider our afterlives to be the soul rising to heaven. Now we kind of want to think about ways in which we can return to the earth or become one with the earth after our death. And you know, particularly in the US, we've seen the rise of options like human composting, sometimes called natural organic reduction or terramation, as well as other technologies like alkaline hydrolysis, which is a form of water-based, largely water cremation, similar kind of process of dissolving bodies and leaving bones. And both of those have significant environmental credentials. They make claims about the carbon footprint. But there's quite a gap, I think, between, in some ways, this kind of romantic imaginary of, you know, lay me down in a bed of moss surrounded by flowers and trees and fungi, which is beautiful and meaningful. And clearly people are deriving a lot of spiritual significance from that image of death. And the kind of more boring and practical logistical challenge, which is actually reducing the carbon footprint of our death care system. Unfortunately, a lot of the things we could be doing to make our death care greener are really boring. And they're like,
such as
better irrigation systems at cemeteries, better filtration systems on our crematorium. Like, this is what I mean. They're kind of like technical engineering solutions to our death care systems, which are very, very important for the era of peak death that we're entering into. They're not always
coinciding, as it does, with rising global temperatures and the challenges of that.
Mm. Exactly. They're not always the same things that make people feel good about their end of life, the kind of aesthetics of how they want their death to look like. I think it's possible to do both. And I think what we should be doing is trying to do both, right? Provide people with this new way of making meaning about death, which is very much tied to this kind of sciencey spirituality that sometimes we've talked about, this kind of Carl Sagan, we are all stardust, right? A kind of a very science-based way of seeing ourselves in the world. And I mean that, you know, as much as I kind of want to object to the green death, like this is also how I very much see myself as, you know, Buddhist and reincarnating to the extent that my body will be reincarnated through its reincorporation into the natural world. Right. Mm. And that like important sciencey spirituality is ever more present in Australian society. But we need to find ways to honour that But then we also need to find ways that do the boring stuff for our death care system.
Hannah, you said that, you know, it's 12 years now since you were bereaved of a parent, of your dad. You've been teaching and studying death ever since.
Yeah.
What would you say is the best thing about studying death that's come into your life as a result of not just staring mortality in the face, but thinking about it, investigating it, speculating on it? What has the gift of it been for the way you live?
I think at the end of the day, it is an appreciation of beauty and this idea that beauty is for me like an aesthetic being in the world really is the antidote to despair when it comes to like dealing with that existential distress of our mortality. And it's really interesting when you talk to palliative care nurses and you talk to people who spend a lot of time with people at the end of their lives, it is our sensory being in the world that very much matters. So it's the feeling of sunlight on your skin, it's the taste of food, the laughter of a child, you know, the texture of your dog's fur. Like, that is the thing that matters to people at the end of their lives. And so as much as death is often depressing and it's hard to make changes in policy and it's hard to even get people to have a conversation about it, whenever I'm so concerned or, you know, feel anxious about mortality, about the fact that I will die and everyone I love will die and the human race will die and the planet will explode, which I do think about quite a lot.
It's a long way into the future.
It's a long way into the future, but at the end of the day, the world is so beautiful. And studying death, I think, has given me a greater, greater appreciation of that, of the fleeting beauty of being in the world. And I don't think I would have got to encounter the sharpness of that experience without coming to meet death so early in my life.
That is a call to attention if I've ever heard one. It's been such a pleasure to have you on Soul Search.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Hannah Gould is a cultural anthropologist at the University of Melbourne and the author of How to Die in the 21st Century. I'm Meredith Lake, with you for Soul Search here on Radio National and by podcast with ABC Listen. I don't know about you, but I do think about my mortality. It's an age-old conundrum, and at the same time, there's a lot that's new about death and dying at this point in the human story. I'm struck, for example, by the trend towards professionalisation. For lots of us now, death will involve doctors, nurses, counsellors, funeral directors, and as Hannah reminded me, all the folks involved in the practicalities of cremation. But the next person you're going to meet imagines something more low-key, perhaps more relational. Could local communities skill up and play a larger role in caring?
You know, this is the way that we grieve better. It's our bridge back to each other, is what I often say. It creates opportunities for us to practice being together. It creates opportunities for us to slow down and truly tend each other, whether that is in through the dying process or in death care, hands-on death care, hands-on community death care practices, or in commemorating and ritualising, holding each other, being with each other through bereavement.
Emma Beatty runs a deathing support practice called Before and After Life, which is all about reimagining the ways that people navigate caring, dying and grieving. She's based in Mullumbimby in the Northern Rivers region of New South Wales. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Meredith.
It's interesting to think of death care as something skilled, but skilled in a community, not just by professionals. What is the role of community, do you think, in having and developing and sharing those skills?
It's critical. It's vital. And what we know, there's some really great research around the care that we offer each other, particularly in those first moments after a death, and how that fortifies us and holds us through the bereavement process. So it's vital that we are in participation as communities through that experience of end of life, death care and bereavement.
You've been working for 5 or 6 years now in that death care space, Emma, and I'm curious about what exactly it is you do. You describe your work as deathing, but that's not a term I've really come across. So I wonder if you could just sketch it out for me. What kind of work is it? What kind of skills do you need to draw on in order to do deathing well?
Great question. I love that. Do you know, I work very intuitively. I read people, I feel into people. You read the spaces in between. What I really do, you know, I facilitate people and groups. I do training in grief literacy and death literacy, or grief and death awareness is another way of saying that. Talking about how we can re-language death and dying and grieving, you know, there's so much possibility in re-languaging, I think, and not using those platitudes and the cliches and, you know, catchphrases that are kind of dished out during this time, but actually really feeling into what is alive in us. And I guess that's where the deathing comes in, is that deathing is alive. It's not static. It's something that we are doing. We are in participation and relationship with people and communities.
So what kind of language around death did you grow up with?
Very integrated with nature. I grew up in a household where death was not taboo. In New Zealand, you know, I grew up with a single parent and my mum was very open. Nothing was ever not on the table for discussion. And so that offered me, I believe, a capacity to be with more difficult conversations. And people in our family, you know, died, and my grandparents had a farm. So, you know, I spent a lot of time on the farm. So death and dying was around us all of the time. You know, not every lamb that was born would make it. You know, the animals, you know, would go off to the works, and you know, my uncles would slaughter the animals for, you know, food for the family. Interestingly, my mum became a vegetarian later on. So death and dying was really just all around. And I don't know, it's just normal. I sometimes say to people, look in the bottom of your fridge. You know, there's a grotty old piece of carrot there. Or look at the leaf litter in the garden. You know, if you've got a compost. Like, those places of death are also very, very alive, and there's a vitality to them. So this continuation of cycles, I believe, you know, living in relationship with the cycles of nature is really my language for death and dying and grief.
It sounds like there's almost a spiritual element to the way you approach this very intuitive kind of accompaniment that you do, Emma. Is that putting too much of a read on it?
Oh, I just got goosebumps, Meredith. It's very true. It's very, very true. And I think the deeper that you get into this work, and the more you are in service to this work and to people and communities, the more interconnected you realise everything is.
Somewhere in the mix of your tasks and activities, I know that somewhere in there is a process of coffin weaving. It sounds very organic to me, in step with what you've been talking about, Emma, but what is it? And paint me a picture of how and why you do it.
Oh, it's the most incredible practice. And as you say, it is organic. It's completely natural. And I think there's a lot of, there's a lot of greenwashing in the death care industry. And the coffin weaving, the fibre is harvested. It's called cat's claw, and it's an invasive species. And then, you know, we sit around in a group and we process that fibre, and then we're sharing. And as our hands are making, we are tender with each other, and we're talking about our experiences of death and loss, or perhaps the person who has commissioned the coffin. And it's just incredibly bonding. And what we find is that people talk very, very easily about what is alive in them as you're sitting together in this very slow process of making together. So I do the coffin weaving with Zimmy Forrest, who is an incredible fibre artist. Really, really beautiful practice. I can't say enough about how bonding it is and how cathartic it is and how we are so famished for each other and for the slowness of being together and the sharing.
Hmm. How is this slow, bodily, relational kind of work that you do connected to that wider commitment I know you have to social justice? I mean, you're describing such a social thing, such a communal, connected, relational thing. How is it part of that bigger interest that you have in social justice?
Well, I guess dying is understood to be a relational and spiritual process rather than just this kind of physiological event. And I think when we come together and we experience this, there can be quite a sadness actually in realizing how distant it is in our day-to-day life. And I think that in this, the value of death is really overlooked. I know that seems a strange thing to say, but
the value of death.
The value of death, of being together, of creating these experiences, these shared experiences together, it really is so fortifying and strengthening. And at a time where people are so isolated and so lonely in their experiences of dying and their experiences of loss, the value of death are these networks of care. That's what it is. You know, these ecologies of care that can start to form around dying and death care and grieving. And that's ultimately what we people are hungry, we're famished for. You know, these opportunities really bring us back to being present. And they create also new forms of storytelling about what it is to be human at this time, what it is to be alive, what it means to die. You know, the fears that can come up around that and the stories that we also might, you know, carry forward.
Hmm. What's your sense of the need for storytelling around this now in Australia today, in your region in particular?
It's everything. It's everything because these things, stories are like anchors. It's the anchorage that we carry forward. So particularly in those first moments after a death, the stories that we construct around what happened, what our relationship was to that person, who was there, you know, what the light was like, where we were, what was said, that becomes then a story that we carry forward. Or, you know, the moment of turning down the shroud over somebody's face. You know, these very, very small gestures land in us as anchors that we start to construct our own narrative, and how we then can take some of those moments forward and practice them. And then that's what can become ritual. Because if you're not a person of faith, or you don't have a sense of, you know, spirituality, then what will those stories be? We don't have necessarily pillars, you know, to carry us through. So stories, I mean, we're human. That's what we're made of. Story.
Emma, you've accompanied people through many phases of this journey, caring, dying, grieving. And I guess I'm curious about what has stayed with you most deeply from the particular experiences of accompanying people, families, individuals through death, that you think have become part of your own story perhaps, or your own outlook?
They all stay with me. It's the truth of it. You know, all of the people and the families, you know, that I have companioned, they stay with me. You know, this morning I woke up very early this morning and I could smell smoke. And I was thinking, what is that? Is the window open? No, it wasn't open. Where is the smoke coming from? And then I clicked. Oh, I know who that is. They all come. You know, and this is what guides me in the work. You know, this is not something that I ever saw myself doing as an 8-year-old. Mm. Not at all. They guide me. I don't know how else to say it, but life is rich with symbolism, and you hear them and you smell them and you feel them.
Mm. You're describing death in a way that makes me think it's not the opposite of life, but a twin to it or something more like that.
Yeah, I was thinking about this on the drive here, actually, and I saw this beautiful piece of artwork recently, you know, of the, you know, Persephone in the underworld. And I was thinking about the bridge to Terabithia, actually, on the way here, thinking of you and that book. And I was thinking, you know, this death and dying and grief is this kind of bridge back to each other, but also it's not a world of monsters and darkness, you know. It's like Persephone going into the underbelly, into the underworld with Hades, but also coming with her mother and, you know, picking flowers. And it's, this is the dance. It's not this or that. It's wholly integrated. And the more that we can live with death close to us, the sweeter those flowers smell with Persephone. You know, the sweeter and more precious life becomes. It sounds like such a junky cliche, but it's deeply true for me, at least.
Hmm. You've spoken about ecologies of care, doing dying and death well. How do you think we could, and I mean we as a community, as a society, even as a nation, could do death care better than we are now? What's one step in what kind of direction that you'd like to see?
I would just love people to be brave and to lean into what feels really hugely uncomfortable and perhaps unnatural, although there's a lot of intuitive feeling into death care. But I would just invite people really to be participatory, because even if the person that we are supporting, the person that we are tending, is not super close to us, we are essentially initiating ourselves into death care practices. And that's important because we too will die one day. You know, nobody gets out alive, is, you know, what everybody says. You know, this apprenticeship of participation is really vital for our own mortal reflections, but also in growing our capacity to love each other more, growing our capacity to be with each other in really difficult times. Yeah, I think it's such a gift. We mentioned the value of death before, and I really do see and believe that there is so much relational value in death and in grief.
Mm. What's the gift of that been to you? I mean, as someone who thinks about death much more than I think most people, perhaps, Emma, what would you say it's brought to the quality of your own life?
More truthful conversations. Mm. 100%. It's also really what drew me into this space, because I was feeling a little bit like, where are the people that want to have real conversations? I'm so tired of this performance and of this rhetoric and of all of this veneer. And as I started training and I started volunteering home hospice, I just went, oh, this is where it's at. This is truthful conversations. Life is real. This relationship is real. We are here quiet and slow, or we're here and we're roaring and loud if we're, you know, working and moving grief through. It's just truthful. It's honest. And I don't think there are many places of authenticity in life in these current times.
I wonder what sustains you in it. I mean, you clearly love this work. It's been profound in terms of your own community connections. But I wonder if this is underpinned on some level by personal practices, whatever they may be for you, because for all the gifts, I'm sure it's not easy. So what enables you to do it day in, day out?
Deeply you know, into being interrelational, you know, deeply connected to nature. You know, if I'm going out to the washing line, my feet, my bare feet are on the earth. You know, I feel the dirt. I can smell the garden. I have conversations with the birds. I, you know, talk to the trees. I watch life and I am in communion, I guess you could say, with life. And also, there's a mutuality in real relationships. That's love. When you're having truthful conversations, even if they're hard, there's a huge loving practice. You know, it's the practice of loving myself, loving the natural world, loving the relationships that I hold dear, and loving practice, the practice of love for other people who are suffering.
To tell you the truth, Emma, I am coming to terms myself with a diagnosis that is not going to kill me, I don't think. The doctors don't seem to think it will. But it's been an occasion for me to make that step from knowing that we will all die to the more immediate contemplation of I am going to die. And possibly that's not as far away as I had assumed. Either way, it's been very clarifying of lots of things, not least the love that is extended to me not only by the people closest to me but by complete strangers who by their taxes contribute to my medical care. You know, it's been an incredible opportunity to receive those gifts of care in all their forms. I mean, this is a very present thing for me right at the moment, but how do you contemplate your own death? Again, because it's different to accompanying other people through theirs, if I can ask you such a personal question.
Well, first, every care to you in that diagnosis, and I trust and hope for you that you navigate that with a lot of love and a lot of care around you.
Thank you.
Contemplating death is a daily practice. I have a practice that I call lasts, and that might be, this is the last time I'm going to hang the laundry on this line. It might be, this might be the last time that I put my child on the bus to school. I mean, you can't live like that in every single moment of every single day.
It would be difficult.
It would. But so bringing that practice into my daily being brings death. It's interesting. I was looking after some kids last week for a few nights, and the kids, you know, before dinner, were having a conversation about what would be, you know, your idea of the best ever day. You know, they were very, very simple things. They were things like, well, I'd get to read all my books. I would, you know, get to have my favourite dinner. I would get to hang out with my friends. I could have a sleep. Very, very simple things. And I said to them, you know, what's really interesting to me is that at the end of life, it's also very simple. You know, the things that are most precious are very, very simple. It's having a window that has a view to the trees. Can I see the birds? Where are my loved ones? Who am I spending time with? You know, it's very, very simple. And I think in our big, messy, loud world, getting slow and quiet and present to the imminence of death brings great richness and preciousness to life.
Emma Beattie, who runs a deathing support practice called Before and After Life, speaking to me for Soul Search from the Northern Rivers region of New South Wales. I'm going to keep thinking about that idea of ecologies of care and about the potential role for communities as we all navigate death, dying and grieving. Thank you so much for your company as we've had these conversations, and a special thanks to everyone who's been in touch with me lately. You can email anytime at soul.search@abc.net.au. This episode was produced by Rowan Salmond and Hong Jiang, and remember, you can listen anytime by searching for Soul Search on ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.